Miracles, A Preliminary Study, C.S. Lewis, HarperCollins, 2001, 294 pages. A brief book summary from Books at a Glance. About the author. C.S. Lewis was one of the most influential writers of Christian literature in the 20th century. His works sell more copies today than ever before. Lewis's writings range from technical academic works, his works on medieval English literature are still considered magisterial, to popular apologetics, to children's literature, and more. Overview. This book explores the philosophical and theological issues that surround the subject of miracles. Lewis looks at the relationship between worldviews, probability, history, science, and theology. He examines different conceptions of nature and reveals how our assumptions have created misunderstandings about the miraculous. He also points out numerous missteps, logical fallacies, and unwarranted presuppositions that keep people from believing in miracles. Since the miracles in the Bible have a particular context, Lewis seeks to demonstrate why the biblical accounts are coherent and why we should accept them. He then sketches their significance and discusses how they point ahead to the glory of a new nature that God is making. Table of Contents. Chapter 1. The Scope of This Book. Chapter 2. The Naturalist and the Supernaturalist. Chapter 3. The Cardinal Difficulty of Naturalism. Chapter 4. Nature and Supernature. Chapter 5. A Further Difficulty in Naturalism. Chapter 6. Answer to Misgivings. Chapter 7. A Chapter of Red Herrings. Chapter 8. Miracles and the Laws of Nature. Chapter 9. A Chapter Not Strictly Necessary. Chapter 10. Horrid Red Things. Chapter 11. Christianity and Religion. Chapter 12. The Propriety of Miracles. Chapter 13. On Probability. Chapter 14. The Grand Miracle. Chapter 15, Miracles of the Old Creation. Chapter 16, Miracles of the New Creation. Appendix A, on the words Spirit and Spiritual. Appendix B, on Special Providence. Summary, Chapters 1 and 2. Every event that we might interpret as a miracle is an event that is perceived through our senses. We know, however, that our senses are not infallible. Our senses can play tricks on us, and we can be fooled by illusions. The way that we interpret our experiences depends on our philosophy. Some people believe that we can determine, using normal standards of historical investigation, that miracles have happened in history. These standards, however, cannot prove whether or not miracles are possible in the first place. We must think through the philosophical issue before turning to the historical. Certain critics deny that predictive prophecy is possible. So whenever they read the Bible, they say that the books that contain predictions were written after the events took place. If a person doesn't know if predictions are possible, pointing them to a text where a prediction allegedly occurs will not solve the problem for them. I use the word miracle to mean an interference with nature by supernatural power. Naturalists believe that nature is all there is, so there is nothing outside of nature that can interfere with it. Supernaturalists believe that there is something more than nature. The first task is to determine which position is right. Naturalists believe that everything simply exists and is going on of its own accord. Everything that happens is determined and there is no free will. The entire system, which consists of everything, exists as a brute fact. Supernaturalists believe that reality must be divided into two camps. The great self-existing fact is the supernatural, and everything else is what he has made. This book will refer to the self-existent reality as God and will assume monotheism. Naturalists see nature as an unfolding, united process that exists on its own, whereas supernaturalists believe that the space-time universe has been created. If the supernaturalists are right, then God could possibly interfere with the natural system he created. This doesn't mean that he does or that miracles have happened, but miracles become a philosophical possibility. In naturalism, miracles must be considered impossible. Chapter 3. Given naturalism, in principle, everything is explicable on the basis of the whole system of nature. The possibility of knowledge depends on the validity of reasoning, and our reasoning must apply to the external world in order to be valid. An account of our reasoning must not be self-refuting. Naturalism faces the cardinal difficulty of accounting for our reasoning in a way that destroys its validity. And when our reasoning cannot be accepted as valid, then our reason cannot be used to support naturalism. In order for reason to be valid, there must be logical connections between our beliefs. We must base our conclusions on logical steps and grounds. Naturalism, however, describes our reasoning in terms not of grounds and logic, but in terms of grounds and effects. In other words, naturalism gives us an account of our reasoning that is based on naturalistic cause and effect relationships, rather than from conclusions that follow from logical grounds. Our thinking is simply one natural event in the long history of natural events, and it is occurring on the basis of non-rational causal relationships. Naturalism completely explains away our reasoning. It reduces it to determinism and material responses to physical stimuli. Our thoughts are determined responses, which is completely different from perceiving truth. Seeing light and knowing what light is are two different things. Through experience, animals come to associate things, like smoke with fire, but they do not make inferences. An inference comes when we see the universality of connections. Inferences occur when we reason from axioms on the basis of the laws of logic. Reason is not based simply on past experience, but on the very different reality of simply seeing that some things must be so. Both naturalists and supernaturalists believe that human reasoning is valid. The difference is that naturalism's account of human reasoning is self-refuting. We need to show how our reasoning can be justified, and cause and effect natural processes are not sufficient. How can evolution produce a completely naturalistic organ that can somehow see truths of logic? Furthermore, we could never know that valid reasoning could confer survival advantage without making inferences to justify that conclusion. Naturalism begs the question. If it is your reason that is being tested, you can't rely on your reason for the test. Inescapably, we must accept reason as our starting point. Naturalists cannot do this in a consistent way, but theists believe that reason is older than the universe and that the universe was created by God to be a place that we could know and understand. God's reason illuminates our minds, freeing us from the cycle of naturalistic cause and effect relationships. The divine reason allows us to perceive the truths of logic and reasoning so that we enter into the freedom that exists when our knowledge is determined by the truth that we know. Some things must be as they are, and when we see that, we enter into a freedom that is determined by the essence of truth. Chapters 4 and 5. Something beyond nature is in operation whenever we use our reason. We may feel more comfortable with the supposition that there is nothing outside of nature, but this does not make it so. Materialism and our own bodies cannot explain the reality of mind. Our minds are offshoots of the divine mind. Mind precedes matter, not the other way around. Our ability to reason is due to God sharing the light of reason with us. Since nature is incapable of explaining our minds must be anchored to something that is not part of nature. Naturalism destroys the validity of our reasoning. But theism allows us to make sense of it on the grounds that God created both the physical world and our minds, with the former being understood through the latter. Naturalists cannot deny reason without relying on it, so they find themselves stuck. Many naturalists do, however, deny human values and morality. When we make moral judgments, we simply see their truth the way we see the truth of logical principles. But when people make moral claims on the basis of non-moral factors, we reject the validity of their reasoning on the basis of their bias. For example, a person may defend the right to have private property because they are rich. People often accuse others of holding moral beliefs on the basis of non-moral factors, and they also strenuously defend themselves when they are charged with being guilty of the same. So we see that people do not accept moral claims if those claims are generated by non-moral causes. This is true for individual moral judgments, but it is also true for morality as a whole. If all of our views as to what people should and should not do have been generated from non-moral causes, then none of them is binding or properly moral in the first place. Given naturalism, statements like "I ought" and "I ought not" are nothing more than descriptions of the individual's feelings. They are natural rather than moral responses, like feeling sick. How we feel is based on non-moral and non-rational materialistic determinism, so our moral judgments cannot be credible. In this model, naturalists must deny the objectivity of morality. They cannot do this consistently and are forever slipping back into moral assumptions and judgments. Our human condition shows that we are genuinely moral creatures, but morality cannot arise out of nature. Just like with reason, morality is anchored in something outside of nature. Morality and reason come from the divine. Chapters 6 and 7. Some people will object that there are proofs of naturalism. For example, our rational thinking is affected when we are hit on the head, and our moral views are shaped by our culture and geographical location. These factors, however, do not prove that nature alone is responsible for our thinking and morality. The supernatural and the natural meet at a frontier. Reason operates as far as our brain allows, and timeless morality intersects with our cultural backgrounds. Other people will object that if supernaturalism were true, it would be far more obvious. But when things are too obvious, we simply take them for granted. When we look outside through a window, we don't tend to notice the window. When we speak our mother tongue, we don't tend to analyze our grammar. We think about a variety of things, but do not think about our thinking. When we think about our thinking, we are led to see that there must be something more than nature. Until recently, people were in touch with the teachings of mystics, seers, and philosophers through tradition and authority. Today, however, people are expected to reject all authority and tradition and discover everything on their own. Since most people are not seers or philosophers, this imposes a burden on the masses that they were never designed to bear. We can believe that God exists, and yet not believe that miracles are possible. God may have designed the universe in such a way that he never intervenes in it. Some people argue that our current scientific knowledge has proven that miracles do not occur. This claim is false. Science operates on the basis of experience, but experience can only tell you what normally happens, not what is possible. Observing norms does not tell you whether there can be exceptions. Discovering rules does not tell you if the rule can be suspended. Joseph was going to divorce Mary because he knew perfectly well how babies are normally made. The virgin birth was as much a violation of Joseph's experience as it would be for a contemporary gynecologist. In fact, the only way that someone can think a miracle has occurred is if they already know the way that things normally work. They must know the rules before they can identify the exceptions. Other people argue that God's special intervention for the human race made sense centuries ago when people thought that the earth was the biggest thing in the universe and that human beings were special to him. This objection is based on an incredible factual error. In the Dark Ages and the Middle Ages, Earth was simply not viewed as the center of the universe. Even ignoring this, the argument fails anyway. How do we know that the Earth is too small to be valuable? Are value and size really linked like this? All of space and time are small to God. Christians do not believe that God loves the world and that Christ redeemed the world because it is big enough to love and redeem. On the contrary, they believe that God loves the world because of the infinite nature of his love. Chapters 8 and 9. Nature's laws are understood in different ways by different people. Some people believe that the laws of nature are necessary truths, and then they conclude that this makes miracles impossible. But even if natural laws are necessary truths, the conclusion that miracles are impossible does not follow. The laws of physics dictate what will happen when two billiard balls collide, but they do not say whether or not someone will reach in and interfere. Miracles do not need to break these laws. God can interfere in accordance with the laws of nature. God could make a spermatozoan in a virgin's body, but then the laws of nature would take over. A miraculous conception leads to a normal pregnancy and delivery. Miracles do not break laws. They feed new information into history and create fresh starts. They are not interlocked with the natural past, but they are interlocked into the natural future. As such, miracles do not violate natural laws, but they do produce something in nature that she could never produce herself if she were let free from the interference of someone outside. As an atheist, I was repulsed by the idea that nature was made by something outside of herself. This seemed to reduce the world to a proper stage scenery. Yet when we realize that nature is a creature, we are freed from trying to see her as the absolute, and we can begin to truly take her with her good and bad points. Christians believe that nature is corrupted, yet she still retains her flavor. Only supernaturalists are really able to see nature for what she is, because they have the proper perspective and distance from her. They know that nature is not the ultimate reality, and therefore can allow her to stand in both her beauty and ugliness. Nature herself will be redeemed in the end, but she will still be recognizably herself. Chapters 10 and 11. Many people reject Christianity because it seems too primitive. Apparently, some ancient people believed that God lived in the sky and had a son who came down to earth, and who then returned back to the sky to sit on a throne. Today, people cannot believe such things. Our pictures of things, however, and the truth behind the pictures are not identical. When we picture London, we see an image that is not what London really is. Nevertheless, we can think about London and study London, even though our mental picture of London is never close to what the city actually is. There was a girl who didn't think that aspirin was poisonous because when it was crushed, it wasn't full of horrid red things. Her mental picture of poison was quite wrong. But that doesn't mean her thinking about poison was inaccurate. She knew it was harmful and you shouldn't swallow it. Whenever we talk about things that we cannot directly perceive with our senses, we must still use the language of sense perception. For example, I see your point. There is simply no way to talk about supersensible realities without using language metaphorically. In order to talk about things we cannot see, touch, or hear, we need to speak about them as if we could see, touch, or hear them. When Christians talk about spiritual realities, they will find mental images in their minds. But the presence of these images does not mean that their thinking about them is false or absurd. Even if early Christians took the images literally, it doesn't follow that they were wrong about everything they thought about the images, in the same way that the girl who pictured poison as horrid red things would not be wrong not to drink something she knew was poisonous. An early Christian might really think that Jesus physically went up through the sky to sit on a chair. If they later came to take the image metaphorically, they would lose nothing, since the point for them was always that Jesus was ruling and reigning over all. The Bible itself gives images of God while denying he can be pictured or seen. It says that God lives in heaven even though he made it, that he lives above the earth and that he fills the heavens and earth. These are statements of spiritual truths, not physical science. When the Bible speaks about miracles, however, it is not speaking metaphorically. We know this because the miracles actually could be experienced through sense perceptions. They were seen, heard, felt, and observed. The language of description for biblical miracles, therefore, is literal and historical rather than metaphorical. Some people believe that there is a supernatural being, but they do not believe that he would interfere with nature. Much religion reduces to a vague pantheism. In fact, a pantheistic view of God is what people naturally gravitate towards. Pantheism sees God as diffused through everything like a gas, and everything is part of him. The pantheistic God is subpersonal, a formless everything. Christianity denies this and insists that God is superpersonal and particular. He is the absolute, the real thing and fact that creates other things and facts. Far from reducing the grandeur of God, this view magnifies it. Contemporary theologians tend to reduce God to negatives, impersonal, incorporeal. But because they lack the positive vision of the sages, they fail to see that God is more than a blank, absolute negation. In regards to God, words like incorporeal and impersonal are not as accurate as transcorporeal and transpersonal, because he is more, not less. We are the ones who are incorporeal compared to God's fuller existence and life. We are less substantial than he is. The biblical pictures are not too strong and concrete. They are not strong enough. Spirit should be thought of as heavier than matter. And once we see these truths, we either pull back because we were only pretending to search for God and never expected to find him, or we go on and recognize that with this God, anything may happen. Chapters 12 and 13. Some people think that God is either too royal to bother with nature, or he is too competent a workman to have made something that he needs to tinker with. When we teach students grammar or poetry, we begin by teaching them rules. Masters, however, frequently break these general rules in favor of higher rules that the students don't know. We can only know if miracles are beneath God if we know that they are not master touches, but we are not competent judges of these things. We observe patterns in nature and tend to think that these patterns are the unalterable rules that God must always follow. There is no reason for us to think that nature is the sort of thing where miracles are out of place. Miracles are possible, but whether or not they have occurred is a separate question. How can we determine the probability of a miracle claim? Some historians will simply accept a naturalistic explanation, no matter how improbable, before a supernatural one, even if it seems more probable. But we have no way of knowing if natural events are always more probable than supernatural ones. We can't look at antecedent probability, but only historical probability. David Hume famously argued that we have uniform experience against miracles, but he rejected reports of miracles on the basis of their never having occurred. He argued in a circle. If miracles occur, then nature is not uniform, and if nature is uniform, then miracles never occur. Hume's argument isn't actually based on anything. His conclusion and his premise are the same. How can we know if nature really is uniform? We can never know this by examining experience. Our experience only tells us the way things have been, but this has no logical connection with the way things have to be in the future. Furthermore, even if nature is uniform, our descriptions are always of its internal uniformity. Nothing may prevent someone on the outside of nature from interfering inside of its frame. A naturalistic metaphysic provides no grounds for trusting that our deep intuition that nature is uniform is true. If supernaturalism is true, however, and nature has been created by a rational spirit who has made us as rational spirits, then we have grounds for trusting our intuition about the uniformity of nature. We find it impossible to think about a disordered, chaotic world because a rational spirit couldn't bear one either. Historically, science grew out of this supernatural metaphysic, and it needs it. To reject supernaturalism is to reject science and probability. To have uniformity requires that you be open to the possibility of the miraculous. Thus, our criteria for evaluating miracles will be our intuitive sense of fitness. Some accounts simply seem more plausible than others. Some miracles will fit and cohere with our experience and knowledge. Chapter 14. In Christianity, the grand miracle is the Incarnation. All the other miracles are connected to it. In the Bible, miracles are not isolated displays of power, but an organized invasion. It is difficult to understand the Incarnation, but every other alternative cannot explain the uniqueness of Jesus. What we can see is the Incarnation pulls together everything else that we know. That which is great has the ability to condescend and stoop to the lower. God comes down and takes up the ruined world. Nature clearly reveals a pattern of dying and rising, and that smallness grows into bigness. Some have objected that Christianity fits this pattern too well. They suggest that Christ was just another dying and rising God. But if this is true, why did the Christians suppress that truth? After all, those myths were highly respected and accepted. More importantly, how is that such a teaching would arise from the Jews? They were the only group that rejected such mythology. Furthermore, Jesus was a historical figure who lived in a specific place at a specific time, unlike all the other gods of mythology. So the Christian story fits with the pattern in mythology, but it is historical, and it occurs amongst the only people who had no nature religion. God is the creator of nature and all the things that the pagan gods were associated with, but he was never to be worshipped through the pagan rites and rituals. In fact, Yahweh demands moral worship. Evil in the world is more than just imperfection in creation. It is depravity and wickedness. This evil began to exist through the abuse of free will in both human beings and powerful spirits. Satan uses death as his weapon, but God uses it for good. Before sin, people were ruled by their spirits, but after sin, the physical is no longer under our full control. We know that there is something amiss between our spirits and our bodies. People make coarse jokes because they are uncomfortable with their bodies and they find something funny about them. There is no other species like this. We are also uncomfortable with both corpses and the idea of ghosts. We do not like either the body or the spirit when they are separated. Since we will die, we must submit to God and see that our death can be a mercy by which we die to self. Only someone who volunteered to die could really fully submit to death. Christ did this and died for others. Chapters 15 and 16. Christians do not need to deny that it is possible that miracles have occurred in non-Christian religions, but the probability for Christian miracles is intrinsically higher since they are interlocked with each other and are a part of a coherent plan. There are different ways of organizing Christ's miracles, but we will divide them into the two major camps of miracles of the old creation and miracles of the new creation. When a miracle is connected to things that God does already, but in different ways, it is of the old creation. But when a miracle steps beyond anything that happens already, it is of the new creation. God turns water into wine all the time through a series of natural processes. Jesus short-circuited the process, but the result was the same. Christ multiplied loaves and fishes, but we get crops from previous crops, and the fish have always been under the command to be fruitful and multiply. Even in the virgin conception, we need to remember that no conception, either human or animal, ever occurs without God's agency. Everyone who is ever healed is healed because God has put restorative power in the body. No doctor or treatment can heal a corpse. Medicine can only be effective by working with the body's resources. God ends storms every time there is one. Yet nobody walks on water. When Christ walked on water, he was showing a glimpse of what the new nature will be like. Dead people do not come back to life in the old creation. Resurrection is part of the new order of things. The resurrection is the central part of the Christian message. It is not just about the act of Jesus coming back from the dead, but about his entering into a brand new state of existence. In the resurrection, Christ does something that nobody else has ever done, and he defeated death and opened up a new era. The resurrection is not about the soul's immortality. Jesus is raised in a glorified body. This is not what we would have expected. We are comfortable with thinking that a higher plane would be transcendent or purely spiritual, but we find that the new state is still partly material. The new nature is something that we don't understand very well, but seems in some ways to be a step between the old nature and a purely spiritual dimension. The physical and spiritual are still joined in the new state. Christ is healing the division between the physical and spiritual, our bodies and our souls. For us, heaven is not a state of mind or even a state for our spirits. It is a state for our body, too.